Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jackie Leiden in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Neuroscience is at its most basic level, an understanding of the brain. But how does the brain understand and make art? And what does that have to teach the gray matter, if you will, the methodologies of science? Young science writer Jonah Lehrer, in a brash new book, argues that scientists might want to re-examine the insights and writings of Whitman and Proust and listen more closely to Stravinsky. He points out the insights they had into our neural pathways long before the scientific community caught up. This hour, On Point, what artists can teach us about our minds. And I want to welcome in the studio Jonah Lehrer. Hello.
Thank you for having me.
Can I just read a little of your bio, your very impressive bio? You're editor-at-large at Seed Magazine, a magazine about science in our culture. You're a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford. You've worked in the Nobel Prize-winning neuroscientist Eric Kandel's lab. And you were a line cook at Le Cirque in 2000, and you are all of 26.
You're making me blush.
Never mind the book. I think we'll all want to know how you did all of that. Do you sleep?
Yes, all the time.
Let's talk about the premise of your book, Proust. I wasn't aware that Proust was a neuroscientist.
Well, I'm being a little ironic, obviously. Obviously, Proust wasn't actually dissecting brains while he was writing his novel. But the basic idea of the book, the basic premise, is that there are these artists who have anticipated the basic facts of neuroscience, real truths, tangible truths, which neuroscience only later discovered. And that by interpreting this art, by looking at this art, be it a novel or a poem or a painting, you can extract from the art a set of wisdom, a set of truths which really did anticipate neuroscience.
Take us into the lab with you. Yeah, you write at the beginning of this book that you were performing the strange verbs of bench science. I really liked that. Amplifying, vortexing, pipetting, sequencing, and so on. And at the same time, you were reading Proust, and you realized that he had predicted for you, as you're looking at the literal gray matter, how memory works.
Well, much of science is really manual labor, as anyone who's worked in a lab can tell you. You're always waiting for experiments to finish, a gel to run out, a PCR to finish. And so I got into the habit of, while I was waiting for my experiments to finish, of bringing a novel into the lab. And one day I brought in Swan's Way, and I just got hooked on this French soap opera, which is really a soap opera about one man's memory. And you know, he dips the cookie in the tea and then falls in love and jealousy and all the rest. It's a great, great story. And at a certain point, I realized that Proust really had anticipated what my experiments were telling me. I was working in a lab which studied the neuroscience of memory, what happens in your mind whenever you make a memory. And I realized that Proust had this very modern idea about memory, about how memory worked.
Well, he obviously had a more meandering approach. He's dipping the Madeleine into the tea. But are you saying that there is something about taste or smell or both?
Well, that's certainly part of what Proust anticipated, the idea that our sense of smell is uniquely nostalgic. But I also think he anticipated more general truths about memory, about how our memory is inherently dishonest. And that's a very modern idea, which was discovered in 2000, the idea that the process of remembering changes the memory itself. And Proust returns to that theme again and again in his novel, and that's why it's a novel and not a memoir.
I just want to enlarge a little bit. He certainly is not the only artist that you choose in this novel. Just remind us who the others are.
I talk about everyone from Walt Whitman to Virginia Woolf. I've got Paul Cézanne, a painter, Igor Stravinsky, and even a chef, Auguste Escoffier.
And we'll talk about them, several of them, in a few moments. But how did you choose these people?
It was a pretty idiosyncratic process. After I had my original idea while I was waiting for an experiment to finish and reading Proust in the lab, I then went to my favorite artists, and I couldn't help but interpret art through the prism of neuroscience. My friends would tease me constantly because I'd walk into a museum and mutter about the visual cortex. I couldn't help but read Walt Whitman and think about the connection of the body and the mind and emotion. I couldn't help but listen to a symphony and think about the auditory cortex. So once I had this idea, I, you know, it really changed the way I read my favorite art.
We're talking here on Point with Jonah Lehrer, who is making a new connection between art and science. His book is called Proust Was a Neuroscientist, a bit tongue-in-cheek, but I'll let him make the argument for you. You don't talk about Proust at the very beginning of this book. You go first to Walt Whitman, and I love Walt Whitman and I have always read him, tramped wherever he could tramp in Brooklyn and other places. You talk about things that Whitman anticipated when he was a nurse. He was a male nurse during the Civil War in the hospital.
Yeah, well, I think it's one of the great themes of Whitman's poetry is this emphasis on the body, and that certainly was, you know, was something that reinforced that theme was being a nurse in the Civil War hospitals and seeing these amputees and caring for these young soldiers. But I think Whitman's obsession with the body was the enduring theme of his poetry. It often got him into trouble. He was censored in Boston because he insisted on being so explicit about the body, on being so lewd, what Emerson called almost pornographic. So it definitely got him in trouble too. But this was the theme he returns to again and again in his poetry. That the body is the soul is the body. The body is where our meaning and feelings come from. So that really is one of the big themes of his poetry.
Whitman talked about the spirit recedes from the body just as much as it gives to the body. How is that related to neuroscience?
At the time, of course, we thought the soul, the mind, was in the mind, was in the brain, that these 3 pounds of gelatinous flesh, that's who we were.
Back in the 1860s.
Back in the 1860s. And this also was the height of Victorian prudery. So you have to put women in context and realize just how radical it was to see the body as the main concern, as he puts it, of the soul, to see the body and soul as entangled. But I think now we know, thanks to the work of people like Antonio Damasio, and this even goes back to William James and his theories of emotion, that our feelings are actually rooted in the body, that our feeling of fear is, in a sense, sensing the palpitations of the heartbeat, the rising pulse, the sweat on the hands.
And remind us of who Damasio is. I know that you quote him here in the book.
He's a neuroscientist at USC who he studied. Much of his work comes from studying people who are unable to experience their body, been able to experience those changes in the body that we all take for granted, and thus they've got a very diminished sense of feeling.
If the neurons are actually blocked,
yes.
He's done experiments.
Yes, through lesions, for example.
You talked about the body loop.
And that if you're denied the sense of your own body, you also lose your sense of feeling. And then there's a whole range of cognitive deficits which go along with losing your emotions. So, for example, one of the ironies is that people who are unable to feel their emotions, they become very irrational. So we've always, I think, drawn the distinction between reason and feeling, and you see with these people, for example, that reason is, in a sense, making rational decisions is, in a sense, grounded in our emotions.
And to finish
which are grounded in the body.
Uh-huh. And to finish our own loop, well, you just mentioned the body. Whitman had all these soldiers, these amputees, telling him, I can feel my hand, I can feel my foot.
Yeah.
And scientists, even at the time, wanted to publish more on that, but were sort of shut it down.
Yeah, there was a neurologist, Silas Warren Mitchell, who was the first to discover these sensory ghosts, which is what happens after a limb is amputated. So after the Battle of Gettysburg, there are all these soldiers who said, Doctor, my arm is gone. You cut off my arm, but I can still feel my arm. It's still there. And of course, this is a very tough thing to explain because the arm is gone. So people just kind of deride it as a metaphysical hallucination. But people like Silas Warren Mitchell, who knew Whitman and corresponded with Whitman and supported Whitman, insisted that, no, this is real, and it's because the body and soul are so entangled.
Jonah, would you like to quote a little of Whitman's poetry? Do you have a favorite from I Sing the Body Electric or anything from Leaves of Grass that... You like to use?
Well, you know, I think the title of I Sing the Body Electric kind of says it all. I think, you know, even that simple metaphor, the idea of the body being electric, at the time was a strange idea. The idea that our neurons would traffic in electricity, that was a very controversial idea in the middle of the 19th century. And so I think even that, the title of the poem, shows how Whitman's metaphor was literal, how even though the scientists at the time didn't know the body was electric, that our nerves actually traffic in ions and these minor voltages of electricity, that Whitman's poetry, that specific metaphor, just, you know, one of these minor examples of how a metaphor can be literally true.
Do you think in general scientists and neuroscientists are receptive to the discoveries that artists make? I mean, do they? I would think that for a neuroscientist, illumination is interesting, but I don't know if it is technically in quite the same way for a geophysicist, for example.
To overgeneralize, I think in general scientists are tremendous intellectuals, and I think I've been really gratified by the response of many scientists to this book, who are just interested in what Proust had to say about memory, or you know how Paul Cézanne's paintings anticipated some very modern ideas about the visual cortex, about how we see. I've been really gratified, I think, by the reception of scientists to this book.
Do you think that the brains of artists work differently?
Oh, that's a very, very complicated question. I don't think we know enough to really find the root of creativity yet.
I hope you haven't had to cut one open. You talked about Proust and the hippocampus. We can come back to that in the next portion of our show. But what is the hippocampus?
The hippocampus is the center of long-term memory, to oversimplify a bit. That's the part of your brain which lays down your long-term memories. We still don't quite know how exactly it does that, but if you lose your hippocampus, you're no longer able to make memories.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about how artists and their insights work in neuroscience. And Jonah Lehrer, we were talking just before our break about Proust and the hippocampus and its effect on long-term memory. And, of course, there is that famous, wonderful passage about the Madeleine. Would you explore that for us?
It really is one of the great scenes, I think, of modern literature, when Proust dips this buttery cookie into his lime flower tea and then has the epiphany of his childhood, rediscovers his childhood buried in the crumbs of cookie.
Would you like to read that section of
sure.
Proust?
No sooner had the warm liquid mixed with the crumbs touched my palate than a shudder ran through me and I stopped, intent upon the extraordinary thing that was happening to me. An exquisite pleasure had invaded my senses, something isolated, detached, with no suggestion of its origin. And at once the vicissitudes of life had become indifferent to me. Its disasters innocuous, its brevity illusory, it was me. I had ceased to feel mediocre, contingent, mortal. Whence could it have come to me, this all-powerful joy? I sensed that I was connected with the taste of the tea and the cake, but that it infinitely transcended those savors, could not, indeed, be of the same nature. Whence did it come? What did it mean? How could I seize it and apprehend it?
And what did it mean to you? I want to get our listeners in here and Will in just a moment, but reading from Remembrance of Things Past, how did this all fuse for you?
Well, you know, I think that paragraph captures just the novel is an investigation of memory in a sense. It is Proust trying to come up with answers to these questions. What is my memory? Where do these memories come from? What is the structure of the mind that allows me to recover these memories? So this paragraph really frames the larger question of the book. More specifically, I think this episode, Proust goes on to talk about how it's by taste and smell alone that he recovered his past, that he looked at these madeleines and the patisseries many times and never remembered all these memories. It wasn't until he actually ate the cookie, put the cookie in his mouth, that these memories flooded back. And that is a modern idea of neuroanatomy, that our sense of smell and taste, the olfactory cortex, is uniquely connected to the hippocampus, the center of long-term memory. All our other senses first go somewhere else and then go to the hippocampus. But our sense of smell is uniquely nostalgic.
All right. Let's take a call from Jason. He's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Welcome to On Point, Jason.
Hi. I'm an artist and a scientist. I've always been a visual biologist and a rather technical artist. I'll keep this brief. I have a psychiatric diagnosis. I've done brain research. I'm currently doing a lot of artwork that, rather than using my non-dominant side, I began using my right and left hand simultaneously to draw. And the first things I do that I drew were brain images. I have, in fact, done more details, microscopic images, things that look like Rorschachs, and just sort of to help my mind settle. I had a number of brain injuries, and it's one of the things doing simultaneously right and left-handed activities that seems to shift out of a troubled emotional state and into a very vibrant, real, aware connectedness.
All right. What is your what's your science background, Jason?
I've been a biologist. I taught anatomy at BU to undergraduates. I'm a physical therapist, and most of the work that I do has to do with learning, and I've worked a lot with neurologically harmed people.
All right, thank you. So, Jonah, what do you think is evinced by doing something like suddenly drawing with both pathways, both your right and left hands?
I mean, creativity, as I said before, is a very tough thing to kind of pin down. It sounds like this caller has found a way to unlock his creativity, to kind of tap into his own, his own ideal mental state. I talk about Virginia Woolf, how she was struggling with mental illness her entire life, and how that made her exquisitely attentive to her own mind. So I think there are people often, sadly, because of mental illness, who do become exquisitely attentive to the mind, who do figure out how their mind works. They pay so much attention to it. Woolf talks about how she was always feeling her mind like a pear to see if it's ripe.
And deciding to examine it, of course, in a profound way.
Yes.
The way Whitman did his body.
Yes, and so I think people like the caller illustrate how by virtue of a mental illness, unfortunately, people are often forced to become very, very sensitive to how their mind works.
Let's go to a little fun that you have had here. You've had a lot of fun in the book, but I mean, it's a very serious book with taste and the essence of taste. Your chapter on Escoffier, the cook who you say invented veal stock. Why is he here? Why is a chef even in this book?
He may at first seem like the odd man out, but I think, If, as Briat Severin said, the invention of a new recipe means more to human happiness than the discovery of a new star, then I think Escoffier has discovered lots of new stars. He's made lots of people very happy. He did invent, I think, a specific form of fancy food. Anytime you go to a fancy French restaurant, you're essentially eating variations on his culinary technique.
And he was working where? Remind us.
He was working at the Hotel Ritz, which invented the idea of ritziness. So this was fancy food, and we still follow his basic techniques.
Well, because before he served food warm, it was served for a very different purpose. And remind us what that was. Describe it.
Fancy food, I think, before Escoffier was. Ornate, elaborate buffets, and they really stressed the idea of appearance, how things looked. So Antoine Carême, the first celebrity chef, was known for his beautiful molds made out of aspic or lard or marzipan. The food looked beautiful, was often served cold because it was these huge buffets, and was sometimes inedible. You don't eat a sculpture of lard, no matter how lovely the sculpture is. Escoffier thought this was ridiculous. He thought the purpose of food is to taste good. And he tells chefs in his cookbook, he said, just taste. You always have to taste. Listen to your tongue. And I think it was by virtue of listening so closely to his tongue that he figured out how his tongue worked.
So he's writing in 1903, and he says, look, stock is everything in cooking. Without it, nothing can be done. If one stock is good, the rest of the work is easy. How does this correspond with your own experience and what the brain has to say about taste? You were a line cook at Le Cirque in New York. So how did you...
I think when you first start to work in a kitchen, there are all these rules which seem so random at first. Why does an onion have to be chopped this way for this recipe and this way for the other recipes? And I think over time you learn to appreciate this kind of cultural wisdom. You realize that there's a certain logic to it, that chefs have evolved this body of rules and recipes, which makes sense. The food tastes better when you follow their instructions. So chefs are, in a sense, intuitive chemists, kind of reverse engineering the tongue or the onion to figure out how to cook it best in this particular case.
I can see that that taste is obviously something associated with the brain, but you take it a little further. You talk about this fifth taste. Is the word pronounced umami?
Umami, which comes from the Japanese word for deliciousness. And that's, I think for a long time we had this this canonical idea. These are the four canonical taste sensations. There's sweet, sour, salty, and bitter. And this all goes all the way back to Aristotle. And of course, if you think about the taste of a veal stock or the process of deglazing, which is Escoffier's other big culinary invention, which is where you burn a piece of protein, a chicken breast or a filet mignon in a pan, so they're burned bits of protein stuck to the bottom, and then you add your stock and deglaze it, scrape up all those burned bits of protein and reduce that sauce down, and then add a little butter or a lot of butter in Escoffier's case. And then that's your pan sauce. That's classic French technique.
So wait a minute. Are you saying that because we are protein and we're consuming protein, I don't know how this is going to make everybody feel, that's why it tastes so good to us?
Well, we have this fifth taste sensation, which scientists discovered in the year 2000 and 2002, a taste receptor on our tongue which just responds to the taste of glutamate, which is an amino acid. It's the most prevalent amino acid in life. So we have this taste receptor on our tongue. It's not one of the other four taste sensations, which you can still pick up textbooks which talk about the four taste sensations. Mm-hmm. We actually have five. And I think it was this fifth taste sensation which Escoffier's recipes really emphasize. It was a veal stock is essentially amino acid water. It's glutamate water. It's umami water. And
MSG water.
MSG water. You know, that's why MSG works. That's why we that's why you see MSG in chicken bouillon cubes or in super seasoning or in cheap Chinese food, because it tastes good, because our tongue can taste it.
Let's get another caller on the line. We're speaking with Joan Allaire. He is the author of Proust Was a Neuroscientist, and he's a science writer for Seed Online Magazine. And Lani is calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. Lani, hello.
Hi, Jackie. Hi, Jonah. What an elegant subject you have here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, I Jonah's am subject. An artist, and I paint, I sculpt, I play bass, and I cook. And I find a sensory approach to life to be what helps me to understand everything more complex around me. I proofread and copy edited in physics for years. I did the Frontiers in Physics series out of California for Addison Wesley. And I was so fascinated with the subject that I wanted to understand it more. But my math background was really pretty awful. So I began painting what I was thinking about.
Hmm.
And in fact, did a series called The Metaphor of Memory, because it became very apparent to me while painting this series of 10 paintings that it wasn't so much what we were remembering that was correct. It was our impressions, and we'd remember differently from time to time. So I did an overlapping series of imagery to portray time.
So can you tell us a little bit, you said you did 10 paintings, an overlapping series to portray time. Based on your physics book editing, what was the content of your paintings?
Time. Time. The way that we see time, the way we experience time. Eventually, it became more quantum physics than anything else, portraying light, portraying a person in one painting and then a person in a painting that would be, you know, nine canvases away in the same aspect, but obviously having gone through time and space. All of the things that I thought about along the way were put into these paintings. And indeed, you know, if archivists go through the layers of paint, they'll find a lot of different imagery there as well. Because it's a process. It's all process. I mean, it's how we learn.
All right, Lani, thank you for that very lovely illustration of what we're attempting to talk about here. As Lani was speaking about the content of her paintings, funny, she thought about time and it being a process. I was thinking time equals decay. I was also thinking of your chapter on Cézanne, of course, who really had a tremendous rough ride. I mean, one of the other fun things about this book is to realize how many of these people who we would today call great artists were not only sometimes obscure, but just, you know, hostily treated. Cézanne comes to the Academy in France, and he's just treated with contempt because his paintings are so outside. How is he seeing?
Well, he was ridiculed as a madman. They said these are the paintings of a crazy person, or he's either crazy or just a talentless realist. He's trying to paint realistically and just can't. But Cézanne insisted that he was up to something. He said, this is what I want to paint. I want to take Impressionism, which was still Impressionism was still radical at the time, but I want to take Impressionism to the next level. And that's what he did. I focused a lot in the chapter towards the end of his career. He starts to leave blank spots on his canvases. And you know, and
the spaces in between?
Spaces in between. So he'll paint a mountain with just a single brushstroke, or paint just the outline of the apple. And painters and critics said, Cezanne, you forgot to finish your painting. There's still empty canvas there. And he always insisted, no, I spent 2 years painting this one brushstroke. The painting is done. That empty spot is supposed to be there.
I have to tell you that when I was a young student, also in England, went to France for the first time, went to the Louvre, the Jeu de Paume, and saw the Cezannes because I've been working on a paper. And I never was anything but rapt. It was hard to imagine a time when he was basically telling other painters that they had it wrong, perhaps, or they hadn't thought about things in planes. You do notice the brushstrokes.
Yes, the brushstrokes call attention to themselves. Cezanne is insisting that this painting is made out of brushstrokes. He never wants you to just believe you're actually staring at an apple. He wants you to be very conscious and acutely aware of the fact that this apple is made out of these thick, jarring, linear brushstrokes.
So why did you choose Cezanne? How was he seeing? You said that all sight starts with photons, but obviously that precedes his day and time, so he wasn't thinking photons.
For a long time, I think science had this model of vision as if we saw like a camera, that pixels of light entered the eye and that the mind developed the pixels, much like a camera develops light with film. Vision was bottom up, so to speak. It was simply a reflection of what entered the eye. I think now we know that vision is much more top down than bottom up. That the mind is constantly imposing forms onto reality. That perception and imagination are entwined. And that's a very Cezanne-like idea, the idea that what we see is an act of creation. And Cezanne, I think, is trying to call attention to just how much creativity is in the act of seeing. And how when he paints the mountain with just a single brushstroke, that we still see the mountain because we impose forms onto the world.
And in the end, in this chapter, you write that all the artists that you mentioned here, even Monet, were affected by their very sight, of course, by what they could and couldn't physically see.
Yes, that the Impressionists were a ragged bunch for various reasons. Monet had cataracts and went blind. Benoit had problems with vision. Van Gogh obviously probably drank turpentine.
First I'd heard of that. One of the factoids here that are,
these guys had vision problems. I think you obviously don't want to simply reduce the art into some act of neurology and say that Monet just painted like this because of vision problems. But I think these problems really inspired them to look anew at the act of vision, to really question their own sight.
Well, that would be the last thing you would want to do, isn't it, Joan Allaire, is say that you are the prisoner of your brain. You're talking about where you want the chambers of the brain and creativity to work together and to see how one presages the others. Do you think artists actually think differently, think faster than scientists? Are science encumbered with having to prove everything?
It's really not an encumbrance. That's what makes science so wonderful and so magnificently successful, is that science is methodical. Science does prove. Science is data. You have to do experiments. And as I know from working in a lab, that can be very labor-intensive and takes a lot of time. So in a sense, artists are liberated from the quotidian nature of having to prove stuff. But I think there is something unique about the way artists are able to study the mind from the inside, study experience itself, the reality as we perceive it and experience it, rather than having to break it apart into a list of proteins and acronyms and electricity in the frontal cortex. They can take reality as it is and study that.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking about artists and their deep understanding of the mind. And we're going now to Michael, who's calling from Ashford, Connecticut. Hello, Michael.
Hi. I have a criticism, and I don't mean it in a disrespectful manner, but I think that what you're developing as a thesis is kind of a based on a tautology, in the sense that artists have always been users and creators of metaphors, but so have scientists, and that the metaphoric nature of science, for example, with like the Bohr model of the atom, there is not such a physical thing as a neat little pair of proton and neutrons with, you know, electrons orbiting neatly around it. That it's just a metaphor that, you know, and it was a metaphor that worked successfully. So that my point to you is that you're saying, hey, they're using the same metaphors. You know, Whitman is making metaphoric use of electricity, and darned if it didn't turn out to be electric in a real sense. But to me, that doesn't really amount to much, because we speak the same language, especially at among different intellectual fields.
All right. Thank you very much for that criticism. We accept the critical method here. Jonah, would you like to answer that?
That's a really good point. Most of the arguments I make in the book don't revolve around metaphors. But I think what the caller was talking about, I think, you know, nicely illustrates why it's so important for art and science to work together, because they do share a metaphorical base. For example, he talked about Niels Bohr and his metaphor of the atom. Bohr himself talked about how that metaphor was in part inspired by cubism. That showed him how you could imagine how matter, you know, wasn't so substantive, how it was in a sense a collage. So I think it's really important for art and science to work together to help refine their metaphors. But
I think he was saying that art and science often do speak the same language.
Well, I mean, they certainly speak they're forced to speak in language. But I think, you know, if you look at art and science now, they speak very different languages. Science speaks in acronyms and data and synaptic proteins and, you know, neurons and ion channels. Art speaks in metaphors and novels and characters and plots. So I think they speak very different languages. I think what I tried to point out are some congruencies, how you can look at this art and see how they are descriptions in the end of the same thing, of the human mind.
When I was in college, we had a class where we tried to apply the methodologies of different sciences to literature and painting. And I remember how did Levi-Strauss influence Cézanne, what are the hermeneutics of a particular poem? And we would look at, does medicine have something to say to analysis? We didn't deal with music, but you do. Here, you talk about Stravinsky and what happened when Rite of Spring was introduced to the Parisian public in 1913.
It caused a riot, a literal riot. This was we don't think of the audience for classical music as being quite so raucous, but they started hitting each other. The police had to come. It was a real, genuine riot, and it was inspired by the first 3 minutes of the Rite of Spring.
People were literally, bopping each other?
Yeah. Gertrude Stein talks about how the lady in front of her was hit by a cane. This was real violence, real rage.
I like having Gertrude Stein as a reporter here. I think it just doesn't get better than that.
She was everywhere in Paris those days.
And what was Diaghilev doing?
Well, it was his ballet. The symphony was done to illustrate a ballet choreographed by Nijinsky. And so the ballet was very jarring, too. Both the symphony and the ballet were complete repudiations of the forms that we tend to associate with classical music and ballet.
Now, to try to illustrate your point, we've picked two pieces of music. First of all, we're going to hear some Mozart, the Allegro Vivace movement from his number 41, also known as the Jupiter Symphony. Right, very astral. Now we will listen to some Stravinsky. And Jonah, this, as you well know, is the Augurs of Spring Dances of the Young Girls from Igor Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. I don't know how long it took before the man in front of Gertrude Stein beat someone on the head with an umbrella.
I think right about there.
That was the point, huh? So what was Stravinsky doing, and what was the audience hearing or rather failing to hear?
I think Stravinsky was deliberately rebelling against the forms we heard in Mozart. So you listen to Mozart, the mind can naturally predict you know, in a sense, what note will come next. There are these patterns, and Mozart will shy away from the tonic, from the pattern he set up, but he'll then return to it in the end. And the mind can make sense of that. You can listen to that and, you know, generally sense that the music is moving in a certain direction and that he will return to the melody that's running through the music. I think with Stravinsky, when you hear that staccato emphasis on those certain augers chord, that emphasis is random. It's unpredictable. The mind doesn't know when that emphasis is going to come back. And that's very, very jarring. So he's forcing the audience to scrap all the patterns of music they know. You know, all the Mozart and Beethoven and Wagner, that's all thrown out the window.
You know, as you're talking, I'm thinking all of these artists wanted to be modern. All of them wanted to synthesize and that also break. And we can talk about perhaps some modern artists before the end of the show. But let's get some callers on the line because we have a lot. Jeremy is calling from St. Louis. And Jeremy, you're on point.
Thank you. I'm really looking forward to reading the book. I'm a huge fan of Antonio Damasio. I consider myself kind of an amateur biologist. And what strikes me, what I'm excited about, is the, you know, when I try to share Damasio's ideas or Dennett's ideas with my cohorts, many of them, it's like, well, it's neurology. It's just not my thing. But, you know, the artist or the person, the intellectual who reads Proust, I love this idea that I'm getting from your work of being able to explain it. The caution that occurs to me is I don't think it necessarily flows the other way. I think, you know, once we've done the research and we have the facts, then we can say, oh, yes, like the caller Michael said, you know, this Proust maybe foreshadowed this or explained it. You know, but for, I suspect, for every artist who got it right, there are, you know, 1,000 who got it wrong. And trying to explain science to people, I see this all the time where they're like, well, I know this person who has this idea about, you know, turning water into radioactivity. And so this other, you know, plate tectonics was a crazy idea in its time. So why can't my idea be right? Well, at the same time as plate tectonics, there were 1,000 other ideas that turned out to be nothing.
Okay.
You know, when the research was done.
Thank you, Jeremy. Just very briefly, are you in the sciences?
No, not at all. It's science is informs my life.
Right.
I look to science to understand the world the way some people look to religion to understand the world, and that's partly why I'm so excited about. I'm going to run inside and order the book from Amazon.
Well, Jonah, it doesn't get better than that.
No,
be careful.
Yeah.
hit the brakes first, Jeremy. Thank you. What about that? Is it a one-sided conversation? He said it doesn't necessarily flow the other way.
Well, I mean, obviously Proust isn't going to invent Prozac, and reading Virginia Woolf isn't going to help you finish your science experiments. So I do think you have to be careful in terms of, you know, how we – trying to define truth for both art and science. But I think one thing scientists can get from artists is learn how to ask better questions. I think the mind is such a complicated thing. I think especially as neuroscience begins to ask these very epic questions, the grand question of consciousness, what is the self, the great mysteries of the human mind, I think it's more important than ever that science begin to look at art. People like Walt Whitman and Virginia Woolf have been studying experience, studying the mind from the inside for a long, long time. There's a lot of wisdom there.
And what about yourself? You said that you were always a lover of literature. You had a double major, I think, in your undergraduate years. And so for you, these things are fused, writing and science.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, once I started thinking about Proust, I still can't help but pick up a novel and think about the mind. And to see these two very different cultures, the culture of science and the culture of art, and to realize that they're both trying to understand the same questions.
Okay, you're listening to On Point. Our number to join the conversation is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And now we are going to Joyce, who's calling in from Hopkinton, Massachusetts. Hello, Joyce.
Hello, and thank you. I just wanted to note that this isn't the first time, of course, that science has been anticipated by art. To some extent, the works of Freud were anticipated by E.T.A. Hoffman, who was not only a writer but a composer and painter. He's best known for having written The Nutcracker, and his original version was a far darker thing than the ballet that we currently enjoy at the season. He explored the significance of dreams and the fantastic. He explored forbidden family feelings, and both Freud and Jung found him of great interest a couple of generations later when they were writing, which brings up the question of whether literature sometimes creates a milieu which affects the questions that science asks, or whether it's simply that both both science and literature are based on human perception, and so they tend to come up with some of the same models.
All right.
And my final comment is that I think that sometimes science is so tied to progress and looking forward that it has a real capacity to be surprised that human beings in the past have come up with some of the same concepts and observations. But I would say that maybe it is that nothing is new under the sun.
Or maybe people just don't get out of their labs very much. But thank you very much for that comment, Joyce. What about that? Do you think that science is surprised that it doesn't use some of these conventions that Joyce was talking about?
Well, you know, I think it's a great point about Freud first. I think Freud, for example, wasn't he read Aeschylus, the Oedipal complex, that comes from Greek literature. So it wasn't just E.T.A. Hoffman. I think Freud was very clear about citing his sources, and he found Greek literature very inspirational, ancient Greek literature. But I do think there are some very radical ideas in art, which I talk about in the book, from Cézanne's empty canvases to Gertrude Stein's nonsensical sentences. And I think, you know, it's not just surprising to scientists. It's surprising to everybody that this art, which seems so strange, so bizarre, is actually telling the truth, is actually describing realistic aspects of the mind. So it's not just scientists that are surprised. It's the avant-garde in the cases I talk about in the book turned out to be right. And this art is, you listen to The Rite of Spring, it still sounds bizarre. It still sounds jarring.
Let's go to another caller. Leo is calling from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Hello, Leo.
Hello, and thank you for taking my call. What a fantastic show you have! It's really thought provoking. I'm calling to really comment and to say that the contents of the show or the theme is the interconnectivity of different sciences and all the arts. It's not necessarily specifying any one particular one, but I found out that's it's very similar to the last 6 or 7 years of my work experience being a visual art high school teacher, and I mean, the ideal is to be able to connect every other discipline within every single lesson plan in the unit plan, and that's the ideal. Now, it's easier to go maybe, I think we're within that last 25-year period, not even really a generation of having been taught that in universities for teachers, particularly visual art teachers, to do this. Called the discipline-based art educational program, and it's like as a teacher, any teacher, but particularly say a visual art teacher, or I'm sure. Well, anyway, I just want to say one thing, that it is so obvious to an artist that's the case, but it's nebulous, it's so huge, it's like everything. Just a few maybe literary references, Kurt Vonnegut, and I can't think of the damn name of the title of this book about the twins that, within a proximity of 1 meter, were geniuses, and then when they exceeded that 1 meter, they were not.
Well, Kurt Vonnegut was certainly a writer who was inspired by science, and I think today, do visual arts and science, there are. I wonder if teachers, Leo mentioned that he was one, a visual arts teacher, I wonder if they huddle in their classrooms to think about ways that both can be taught together with whatever switch for an afternoon. That would be fun.
Yeah, that's a great idea. I think the problem with being a visual arts teacher, unfortunately, is that I think we don't. I think our culture too often denigrates art. I think, you know, you can see the cutbacks in education in various kinds of art programs. We too often see art as simply entertaining or a diversion on a rainy day or pretty paintings, and we don't take it seriously enough. I think one thing I tried to do in this book was to take art seriously, to see, you know, is art really expressing something true about ourselves?
Can I just, we just have a couple minutes left, ask you, you did stick pretty much to the 19th and early 20th centuries, but you did say, hey, you could maybe expand this, this is book number two, into modern artists of all kinds.
I talk at the end of the book about Ian McEwan's novel Saturday, which he
which
spent,
is itself a riff on Mrs. Dalloway.
And he spent 2 years following around a neurosurgeon. And the book is very much grounded in the facts of neuroanatomy and these strange adjectives that describe the brain. So I certainly don't think that this synthesis of art and science ended with Virginia Woolf and the modernists. I think there are novelists like McEwan, like Richard Powers, whose last novel, The Echomaker, was based in the Capgras syndrome, a real neurological syndrome, who are Kurt Vonnegut, who are inspired by science, who take the science and explore it in their art and ask questions of the science, interrogate the science. So you know, certainly I think it's still going on. You know, I also think it's important to note that's not the only way to engage with science as an artist. I think you don't simply have to riff on science. I think anytime art moves us, anytime art works, be it Hamlet or the paintings of Jackson Pollock, it moves us because it literally touches a nerve in us. It resonates with us.
Very, very quickly, what are you looking at in your next book?
My next book's about decision making, about what happens in the brain when you make up your mind.
Okay. Well, I have to make a decision now, and that is to say goodbye to you. It's been fascinating. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Jonah Lehrer. This is On Point. I'm Jackie Leiden, and you can join the conversation and keep it going online and download our podcast. Jonah is an editor-at-large at Seed Magazine, and his new book is Proust Was a Neuroscientist. As I said, this is On Point. Thanks for listening.